All right, so as I said, we're going to be in chapter 39. And if you remember when we were working on 38, there was a little bit of a shift because it wasn't so much filled with the condemnation of Israel and the judgment that was going to come. It began to focus primarily on Zedekiah and Jeremiah, and we got to see opposing character traits of those two men, one who followed God and one who feigned following God. You know, I want to hear, but, you know, didn't do anything with whatever Jeremiah told him, God told him. So it's going to continue into this chapter. And if you recall, when we ended chapter 38, that was the time when Jeremiah was saved out of the pit and raised by Ebed-Melech and put back into the prison of the court. So it was an area that was adjacent to the king's palace, where prisoners would be primarily in like a house arrest. So they had a little more freedom to move around, but they weren't able to leave, obviously. So, but at that point when we ended, that was where they said that there was no more bread in the city. Now, when we pick up here in 39, it says it kind of gives a little historical start here. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the 10th month, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army against Jerusalem, and they besieged it. So, again, you know, God is very specific, and we're going to see, I mean, he's very specific here in this chapter. So he makes it clear to us that Zedekiah, who reigned for 11 years, that this is in the ninth year of his reign, and it's in the 10th month. So he's just a couple months from going into his 11th year, or I'm sorry, 10th year. And what happens here is we see that Nebuchadnezzar comes with his army against Jerusalem. And we can't say that that's unusual, because we've seen lots of situations in the Old Testament where David leads his troops into battle. Gideon leads his troops into battle. And Nebuchadnezzar comes and he leads his troops into battle. But what's unusual here is this was not something, this is the third incursion now, and they're going up against the fortified walled city of Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar isn't silly enough to think that we're just going to take the city in a day or two. So he comes, and there's a purpose for him being there. Because if you recall, as we were talking about Zedekiah, Jehoiachin was killed and removed from being king of Judah. And Zedekiah was appointed as king by Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar put him in that office. And all he had to do was pay his tribute money to Nebuchadnezzar. And after the second incursion, he decided, you know, it was after the second incursion that he was put into office. And then, you know, several years went by, and he kept paying the tribute money to Nebuchadnezzar. And then he kind of got full of himself and decided, I'm done with this. I'm not paying him anymore. And he goes and makes his league with Egypt and decides that if Nebuchadnezzar comes a third time, Egypt will come and help him and they'll defeat Nebuchadnezzar. Well, of course, you know, that didn't work out so well, as we saw in the last time that we were together. Nebuchadnezzar completely destroys Egypt and pushes them back. Nebuchadnezzar is here to make a statement. He's like, Zedekiah, I'm here, and I want you to know that I'm here. Nebuchadnezzar takes this personal. Now, how do we know that? Well, one, because he's human, and because he put Zedekiah in office, and Zedekiah basically rebelled against him, he's angry. The other thing that we find out is that his incursion into Judah occurs in the 10th month. Well, why is that unusual? Well, because the 10th month is the winter. And nobody begins a war in the middle of the winter. And if you go to 2 Samuel 11:1, chapter 11, verse 1, it's obviously dealing with King David here, but it says, "And it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still at Jerusalem." So when it says after the year was expired, you have to remember that we're not talking the Gregorian calendar here. It's not January, but their first year of their month was Nisan, which happens to either be the last week of March or the first week of April. So it's in the spring. So the kings would go to war in the spring, not in the wintertime. So that would be a hardship on your soldiers. But Nebuchadnezzar was angry, and he decides, we're going to do this now. So it's really kind of an eye-opener for Zedekiah. You may have thought, like, hey, we've got some time, you know. Nope, you don't have any time. And then when you get to verse 2, it says, "And in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, the ninth day of the month, the city was broken up." So now we know we're in the last year of Zedekiah's reign, and it's the fourth month. So what we have is we have a situation where he's now gone through his 10th year, and he's in a portion of his 11th year. So what's really interesting here is it's like 18 months to the day. So if we look at 2 Kings chapter 25, of course, you know, Kings and Chronicles, they speak in detail of a lot of things that happened with the different kings of Israel. And this is one of those situations where we get a little more detail. This is why we say God is very specific. So it says in verses 1 to 4 here of chapter 25 of 2 Kings, "And it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the 10th month, in the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his host, against Jerusalem, and pitched against it, and they built forts against it round about. And the city was besieged unto the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And in the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine prevailed in the city, and there was no bread for the people of the land, and the city was broken up." The city was broken up, "and the men of war fled by night by the way of the gate between two walls, which is by the king's garden. Now the Chaldees were against the city round about, and the king went the way toward the plain." So when we looked, we said he was in the 10th month that he started the siege on the 10th day here in 2 Kings. And then they actually broke up the city on the 4th month on the 9th day. Well, that makes it exactly 18 months. So it's really amazing. But, you know, that's the dedication that, you know, these wars were not like, oh, we launch a few rockets and, you know, we defeat them. These wars went on and on and on because they had to take city and towns and everything along the way. And then this was just Jerusalem. It took him 18 months just to overthrow the city. But, you know, he starved the people out. So He surrounded it. They built forts around the city, so they surrounded it so nothing could come in or leave. And he basically starved the people. Then in verse 3, it says, "And all the princes of the king of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate, even Nergal-Sharezer, Samgar-Nebo, Sarashim-Rabsaris, Nergal-Sharezer, Rabmag, with all the residue of the princes of the king of Babylon." So the little sheet that we handed out there has a diagram of the city of Jerusalem. And you can see on the right side at the top of the list shows where the middle gate is. And you can see that middle gate, the very next thing from the middle gate is the temple. So he came in, or his princes came in, and they occupied the gate that leads right to the temple. And that's where they set up their place of, what would we call it? Their base of operations, you know. And, you know, the moment that happened, then it's like raising your flag over the city, right? The city is done now. So the princes have now come in and they've staked their claim. We now own this city. So in verses 4 and 5 of Jeremiah chapter 39, we see the amazing backbone of Zedekiah. "It came to pass that when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, saw them and all the men of war, then they fled and went forth out of the city by night by the way of the king's garden by the gate betwixt the two walls, and he went out the way of the plain. But the Chaldeans' army pursued after them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And when they had taken him, they brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah, in the land of Hamath, where he gave judgment upon him." Now there's some minor things that are happening here, but you can see Zedekiah got scared. He saw that they occupied the city, and he decides that he's going to scurry out of the city, try to get away, and obviously that didn't work out for him. So it says that they brought, well, he was heading towards Jericho, and they brought him to King Nebuchadnezzar in Riblah. And you're like, okay, I thought Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem. So when we started, it said Nebuchadnezzar came down. But see, the problem with that is, like we said, it's a long siege, right? It's 18 months. Nebuchadnezzar can't leave his kingdom and just be there for 18 months while they're attacking. So what he does, Riblah is a city that's located just to the east of what we would call Lebanon today. So if you look at where Babylon is and you look at where Jerusalem is, Riblah ends up being just about halfway between both of them. So what Nebuchadnezzar does is he sets up his base of operations there, so he can still have people coming from Babylon and letting him know what's going on, and he can have his military advisors coming from Jerusalem to let him know what's going on. So as you know, things progress, he's kept abreast of what's going on. So they capture Zedekiah and his family members and a number of his men, and they bring him to Riblah, where Nebuchadnezzar ends up taking him and making sure he doesn't ever rise up to be king again. So when we look at verses 6 to 8, it says, "Then the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah in Riblah before his eyes. Also the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah, Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with chains to carry him to Babylon. And the Chaldeans burned the king's house and the houses of the people with fire and break down the walls of Jerusalem. Now, of course, you know, all of that didn't just happen in one day. Because, as we said, you know, they took him to Riblah, which was 200 miles from Jerusalem. So that was a bit of a trip right there. Then Nebuchadnezzar has Zedekiah watch as he kills his family. And that's the last thing Zedekiah sees before his eyes are taken out. So that's the picture that will be in his head for as long as he lives. It's a terrible thing for someone to do. But you see, I won't say the eyes are a terrible thing. Well, it's a terrible thing, but it wasn't commonplace. But the killing of the sons was commonplace because you didn't want an heir to the throne to one day be able to come back and take over the throne again. So he kills all the sons of Zedekiah, which of course fulfills God's promise or prophecy that, you know, there would be no other king after Zedekiah, that there were his generations would end. No other son would sit on the throne. And that's exactly what happens here. So then his troops end up, we'll say some of Zedekiah's men who were with him and his family ended up being killed. Princes who would have been some of Zedekiah's children were killed, and his wife was killed. We don't get that here in this account, but all of this happens because Zedekiah was too proud to just surrender, like Jeremiah said. So Zedekiah could have spared his family and spared himself everything that was happening here. Now, think of the fact that, I mean, his pride was the thing that caused him to not listen to Jeremiah. But now his family is dead, his eyes are put out, he's in chains, and what do? They walk him through the streets of the kingdom of Babylon until he gets to the city of Babylon, another 200 miles, and he's in chains. So the man who thought himself to be something ends up now being treated primarily like a dog on a leash. So things didn't exactly go the way he had hoped. But we can see that everything went exactly as God said, because they destroyed the temple, they destroyed the king's houses, they destroyed the houses of the people, and burned everything. And that's exactly what Jeremiah said was going to happen. They're going to burn your city. So as we continue, we see in verses 9 to 10, then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive into Babylon the remnant of the people that remained in the city and those that fell away that fell to him with the rest of the people that remained. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left of the poor of the people, which had nothing in the land of Judah, and gave them vineyards and fields at the same time. Now, pretty much what happens here is Nebuzaradan, he was a high-ranking official in the army of Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar sends him back into Jerusalem. And he rounds up anybody that's left. And he has him charged with having everybody being taken back to Babylon. Except for those that are poor. So he says that the poor people are left in Jerusalem and they're given the vineyards and the fields. Now, that's pretty interesting, I think. But I'm looking at it from God's perspective. You know, the least shall be the greatest, and the greatest shall be the least. Zedekiah was the greatest, and he becomes a dog on a leash. And those that were poor had nothing, end up being the ones who are now given the land and the farms in the area of Jerusalem, so that they're going to now till those gardens, harvest those orchards, and raise whatever flocks and things are there. Only God can do stuff like that. But see, for Nebuchadnezzar, it works out really good for him, because then he still has a source of something that's going to be brought to Babylon regularly, the harvest and cattle and whatever things that they're growing over there will be brought to Babylon, and the people will be able to enjoy the fruits of their labor. But I think of how when we were looking earlier, I don't think it was 38, but it might have been 37, chapter 37, when Jeremiah tells Zedekiah that Nebuchadnezzar is going to come in and he's going to destroy the city. And what does Zedekiah do? He decides that he's going to free all the slaves, right? So all the servants, all the slaves, he says, in the city of Jerusalem are now free. And it turns out, you know, Egypt attacks, and then the Babylonians go after Egypt, and they leave off the city. And what does Zedekiah do? He puts them all back into bondage. And I think, well, isn't this funny that God would take those people who didn't have anything and then give them the land and the farms that were so important to the upper class people, middle class people? That's how I look at things from God's perspective. I think he's so funny when he does stuff like that. We can't understand the mind of God, but we can truly appreciate it, right? So then in verses 11 and 12 of this same chapter, 39, now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, saying, take him and look well to him and do him no harm, but do unto him even as he shall say unto thee. So what happens is, for some reason, and, you know, I say that tongue in cheek because I'm sure God had his hand in this, Nebuchadnezzar knows of Jeremiah. And Nebuchadnezzar tells Nebuzaradan, I want you to go and find Jeremiah and do whatever he says. So I find that funny, because here you've got one of the chief men, generals of Nebuchadnezzar's army, and Nebuchadnezzar tells him, I want you to listen to this Jew and do what he tells you. That's got to really stick in your craw if you're the Babylonian general, but you know, you don't argue with Nebuchadnezzar, right? So he goes, and of course, where does he find Jeremiah? He finds him in prison, because that's where he was left, right? So in verses 13 and 14, it says, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, sent, and Nebushashban, Rabsaris, and Nergal Sherazar, Rabmag, and all the king of Babylon's princes, even they sent and took Jeremiah out of the court of the prison and committed him unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should carry him home, so he dwelt among the people. Now, a lot of funny things are happening here, because obviously, a number of these chiefs in the military are sent by Nebuzaradan to go and get Jeremiah out of prison. Now, I don't know if that's because there were still people guarding him, or if they expected that there were other people in the city that would rise up and say, hey, you can't let him out. Because remember, the people in Jerusalem didn't do what Jeremiah said either. Those that were left behind. The people that had already surrendered to the Babylonians, they were already gone. So what you have left in the city are those that said, we're staying. And those were the ones that Jeremiah said, if you stay, you're going to die by the pestilence, the famine, and the sword. So now Nebuchadnezzar says, go and free Jeremiah. So it's possible that they thought there was going to be some kind of a conflict that arose. So he sends all of these generals. But what's funny, and I didn't know this, but when I read it, I was like, okay, so we've got one, two, three, four of these princes and all of the other princes that go with them. Well, surprisingly enough, that's not true. It's only two. When it lists Nebushashban Rebsaris, that's actually one guy. So what it is it gives a title of this guy. So you have his name and then you have his title. So this guy, Nebushashban Rebsaris, his title is that he's the chief chamberlain. So he's pretty important to Nebuchadnezzar. And then you've got this Nergal Sherazar Rabmeg. And his name comes, well, I guess both of them, if you look at it, if you remember when we talked about Nebuchadnezzar, we said Nebuchadnezzar, his name was a contraction of Nebo, who was one of their gods, and he put it onto his name. So he ends up having the authority, as it would be, of the god Nebo. And then that's exactly what you have happening here. You have Nebushashban Rebsaris, and of course, you know, the guy that Nebuchadnezzar told to oversee Jeremiah, Nebuzaradan. So they both have that Nebo put into their name. Well, this guy Nergal Sherazar, he also has the name of a false god, and the false god's name is Nergal. So Nergal is one that's listed in 2 Kings as well, chapter 17, and it's one of these false gods that's set up when the Assyrians come in to Israel, the northern part of Israel, or I guess the northern kingdom of Israel. And if you look at 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 29 and 30, remember how they set up a second temple in Samaria, in Gad and Bethel, and that was obviously not something that was condoned by the Jews. But in this section of scripture, verses 29 and 30, it says, "Howbeit every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. And the men of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth, and the men of Cuth made Nergal, and the men of Hemath made Ashima." And then, of course, it goes on and it lists a bunch of others. So they're making gods, and they're putting them up in the high places in Samaria. Nergal is one of those false gods. So this guy, Sherazar, took Nergal to his name. And his name means chief protector of the king. Or, some places say that he's like the Most High. And of course, nobody wants to be giving out that title other than to the Lord. So all of these guys and other princes who are not named go and remove Jeremiah from the prison. And they say they're going to put him in the care of Gedaliah. And Gedalia is listed here as saying that he's the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan. And this is also an interesting thing. There's a lot of things going on in this section of Scripture. If you go back to Jeremiah chapter 26, that was a while ago that we were in that chapter, so it probably isn't too fresh in our minds. But verses 20 to 24 here. Remember, we're talking about Ahikam, the son of Shaphan. So it says in verse 20, "And there was also a man that prophesied in the name of the Lord, Urijah, the son of Shemaiah of Kirjath-Jearim, who prophesied against this city and against this land according to all the words of Jeremiah. And when Jehoiakim, the king, with all his mighty men and all the princes heard his words, the king sought to put him to death. But when Urijah heard it, he was afraid and fled and went into Egypt. And Jehoiakim, the king, sent men into Egypt, namely Elnathan, the son of Abquhar, and certain men with him into Egypt. And they fetched forth Urijah out of Egypt and brought him unto Jehoiakim, the king, who slew him with the sword, excuse me, and cast his dead body into the graves of the common people. Nevertheless, the hand of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, was with Jeremiah, that they should not give him into the hand of the people to put him to death." So what we have, he's just kind of like a byword there. It just was just added as a little something for us to have to think about. But this guy is the son of the guy who made sure that Jeremiah was okay. Jehoiakim didn't find him and kill him. So all we can assume is that he seems to have the same kind of character that his father had, where he was concerned for God's prophets, the true prophets of God. So he ends up being the one who, I say, is one of the people that is to oversee Jeremiah here. So we have Gedalia, who's going to be overseeing him. Now, something happens, and we're not told what that is. But when we get to chapter 40, we find out that Jeremiah is amongst a group of people that is on a march going to Babylon, and he's in chains. So we don't know why that happened, because Gedalia was charged to keep watch over him, but something happened, and Jeremiah ends up being amongst all the masses of the remaining people that were taken out of Jerusalem, being taken over to Babylon. And we'll talk about that next week when we get into 40. But in case, you know, you read ahead and you're like, wait a minute, what happened here? This guy was supposed to watch over him. How come all of a sudden he's in chains? We'll try to answer that. But in the interim, we'll continue. So verses 15 and 16 says, "Now the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah while he was shut up in the court of the prison." So this would be before they came and took him out. So it kind of took a little step back so that, you know, we would see that God has a chat with Jeremiah before he's released. And it says, verse 16, "Go and speak to Ebed-Melech the Ethiopian, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Behold, I will bring my words upon this city for evil and not for good, and they shall be accomplished in that day before thee." Now, this is another one of those situations where you have to look at things from Jeremiah's perspective. He's in prison, and I'm sure even from the prison, he can see that, you know, the Babylonian army is occupying the city. And God decides this is the time to talk to Jeremiah. And he says, he doesn't say, hey, Jeremiah, I'm going to free you. Everything's fine. But he says, I want you to go and I want you to talk to Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, and tell him everything will be fine for him. Now, you know, indirectly, that has to tell Jeremiah, you're going to be out of the prison. Because how would he go and talk to the Ethiopian if he wasn't out of the prison? But do you remember Ebed-Melech? Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, he was the guy that we read about in the last chapter, chapter 38. If you go back to verse 9, 9 to 13 here. Well, all right, verse 8, I mean, you get the name. Ebed-Melech went forth out of the king's house and spake to the king, saying, my lord the king, these men have done evil in all that they have done to Jeremiah the prophet, whom they have cast into the dungeon. And he is like to die for hunger in the place where he is, for there is no more bread in the city. Then the king commanded Ebed-Melech the Ethiopian, saying, take from hence 30 men with thee, and take up Jeremiah the prophet out of the dungeon before he die. And then we understand, you know, Jeremiah, or Ebed-Melech goes, he gets the cloth, he gets the rope, he has these 30 men go with him, and they lower the rope and the cloths to Jeremiah and pull him up out of the pit. And then they put him in the king's court, the prison of the court. But then right after that, that's when Zedekiah calls Jeremiah to come and talk to him and says, you know, I want you to tell me the truth now. Like Jeremiah was lying to him all this time, right? But Ebed-Melech is the guy that saved Jeremiah's life. Now, you have to look at this and say, okay, God is faithful, right? So Ebed-Melech, he was Ethiopian. Now, if you know anything, I mean, that's in Africa. He would be a dark-skinned man and probably didn't look very Jewish. But he was likely a proselyte because he believed in the Lord more so than the Jews who were in the city. And, you know, I kind of think of him... I had her name on my... I'm thinking Rahab. Is it Rahab? Who was in Jericho. And, you know, she hid the spies that were there. And then God tells them to let her know that your life will be spared and your family who are there, right? So God keeps those that put their faith and trust in him. And, you know, even when everything else is around them is going to pot, God has his hedge of protection about those people. So with the invasion that's come into the city, obviously Ebed-Melech is likely to be one of those people who's concerned that, you know, I could be killed here, because Jeremiah prophesied that anybody that was left in the city was going to die. But God says, no, go to him and tell him that I'm going to be the one to watch over you. What a great place to be, right? I don't know a better place to be than to have the Lord specifically point you out. But see, that's what God has done to each of us. He says, you've accepted my son, now I'm accepting you. And that's great. I mean, it's nice to have examples in Scripture of people of faith who God has said, I'm here for you and I'm going to make sure that, you know, you might have problems in your life. You might even die. But guess what? You're going to die just physically with this body, but you're going to have eternal hope. And eternal hope should be a hope that's greater than any hope we have here on this earth. So that's a wonderful thing for him. Then in verses 17 and 18 of this chapter, he says, but I will deliver thee. This is continuing from what the Lord said to Jeremiah to tell the Ebed-Melech, I will deliver thee in that day, saith the Lord, and thou shalt not be given into the hand of the men of whom thou art afraid. For I will surely deliver thee, and thou shalt not fall by the sword, but thy life shall be a prey unto thee, because thou hast put thy trust in me, saith the Lord. Now, I think it's great that, I mean, God confirms that Ebed-Melech's not going to die, and he makes it very clear to him. And Ebed-Melech obviously was a man who trusted God, because God says, you've put your trust in me. Well, he didn't just put his trust in him at that moment, but he put his trust in him that he would actually go to King Zedekiah and entreat Zedekiah to have Jeremiah taken out of the pit. So, you know, who is he? He's the prince of the eunuchs. So, you know, he's a guy that would oversee a lot of the things in the house of the king, but it's not like he's one of the princes or a captain of the guard or something. He's a eunuch. So, you know, he actually took the chance that his life would be in danger to go and spare the life of the prophet of God. And God says, not that you did that for my prophet, but you put your trust in me. So because of his faith and his trust in God, God says, I'm going to be faithful to you. And he ends up telling him he's going to spare him. Now, in the book of Psalms, chapter 91, this is a great couple of scriptures. Psalm 91. There's a lot of places in Psalms that you can go to where you can find comfort. And this probably will be one of those in the day of trouble, right? So in verses 8 and 9, only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked, because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation. So what happens... Oh, well, I probably forgot to say something. But let me go back here because I think the Lord made it clear. Yeah, in verse 16 of chapter 39, he says, you know, go and speak to Ebed-Melech the Ethiopian. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring my words upon this city for evil and not for good, and they shall be accomplished in that day before thee. So he's telling him that Ebed-Melech, I am going to watch over you, but you will be a witness of my judgment that now comes on the city. So you're going to see all of these things come to pass on that day. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but you see, all that can do is really solidify your faith in God that what Jeremiah prophesied does come to pass, and you made the right decision when you stood up for Jeremiah. So, you know, I think God is doing a lot of things in this chapter, and he's really making... He makes a point of, you know, the king who tries to sneak out of Jerusalem, and he ends up, you know, getting his just reward. And then you have Jeremiah, who is faithful to God, who God now has Nebuchadnezzar personally tell his people to make sure everything's okay with Jeremiah and do whatever he says, and then put someone in charge of him to make sure things go well. And then God didn't forget about Ebed-Melech. I think it's great. You know, you might think that you're a nobody and you don't have any standing in society, but, you know, in God's eyes, you're somebody worth God's attention. So, you know, if you put your faith and trust in God, God will never fail you. That's the bottom line. All right. And I'm going to stop here. So we're going to end a little early today. And I'm sure nobody's going to complain. So we'll close in prayer.